This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Lizeth Barón Carvajal. Today, I'll be talking to Dra. Cristina Ramos about her fascinating book titled Bedlam in the New World, A Mexican Madhouse in the Age of Enlightenment, published by University of North Carolina Press in 2022. Welcome, Cristina. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you. Muchas gracias, Lizeth. Thank you for hosting me and happy to chat about my book.
Okay, so I'm so excited to have you here today. This is a really awesome, captivating book. But before we talk about the book, let's start by talking about your personal trajectory. So you're an assistant professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and you obtained your PhD at Harvard History of Science program after you received an MA from Duke University. So tell us more about your personal and intellectual journey. Our listeners always love to hear more about like the personal side of these stories, how you came to your chosen region of study and your particular research interests.
I'm sure happy to talk about that. I think I knew I wanted to become an historian early on. Lucky me or unlucky me. I knew early on that I wanted to study the early modern period. So kind of 15 to 1800 has always been where I've been comfortable. So I've long considered myself an historian, an early modernist, and my training is actually in the history of science and medicine. So I was trained as an undergraduate by Deborah Harkness, a really captivating historian of early modern England, historian of science. And then at Harvard, I worked under Catherine Park, an historian of late medieval and Renaissance Italian science. So it was kind of very traditional kind of history of science and medicine training is what I had in graduate school. The transition to Mexico was a lot more complicated, I think, than it should have been. I didn't want to study Mexico initially. My family's from there. And I've been visiting Mexico since I was a kid. So it wasn't exotic enough initially. So I had long gravitated toward Europe. But I think around the time that I was in graduate school, I just, you know, when you get to graduate school, you start to think of yourself as, you start to realize that this is a professional career. And it was harder at that time for me to, as a Latina, to kind of take myself seriously doing Europe. So it was around that time, around the time that I started the history of science at Harvard, that I kind of knew that I was going to make the leap to colonial Mexico. So that's kind of how the my trajectory unfolded, and I haven't looked back since.
I love that. Actually, for me, it's the other way around. I knew I was doing Colombia from the start, but I wasn't trained initially as a historian of science and medicine. So I love to hear like a completely opposite trajectory. Awesome.
You know, it's for lots of people, it's for a lot of historians of medicine, it's in Latin America, it's the other way around. yeah. I always say I'm a great historian of medicine. I'm a terrible Latin Americanist because I'm self-taught.
I'm sure that's not true. I can tell. And you got awesome mentors. These two women are just amazing scholars. So, I mean, you were so lucky to have them. And this book is a product of that training of yours. And it's, you know, a great piece of writing, piece of history. We'll talk more about that. So tell us more a little bit about that, the kind of turning the dissertation into a book. So this is your first monograph, right? And well, now we know that you didn't initially think of Mexico as your region of study. So how you came to not Mexico only, but to just one single institution, because this book is about one hospital, the Hospital of San Hipólito in Mexico. And so how did that happen? How did the project change from dissertation to book? I always love to hear about these changes because I am writing my dissertation. So it's always encouraging to hear and listen how people deal with that.
Yeah, no. So this project was born in the archives, and the kind of panic and trepidation and fear one feels when you're in the archive for the first time, and the kind of the documents that you're reading through don't really answer the questions that you initially had. And the kinds of negotiations that you have to make in those, in the early phases of research. So that's how this project began. I went to Mexico City on like an experimental archival trip in my graduate training with a kind of a very broad interest in colonial hospitals. I've long been fascinated with these institutions. I still am. I haven't left. I remember when around the time I was reading for my comp exams, looking for a dissertation topic, I remember reading, it was just a casual aside, that the Spanish had founded hospitals throughout their New World possessions because of course they did, right? This was the Spanish colonialism, their founding churches, their founding monasteries, and their founding hospitals. Lots of them. And I found that really fascinating. I had done a lot of reading on European hospitals, kind of pre-modern hospitals, and how they combined, you know, the care of the soul with the care of the body, and how they were, you know, foremost religious institutions informed by Catholic notions of charity and poor relief. And I just became really interested in, you know, what happens when you take this religious institution to this kind of Spanish American setting. So I had larger questions about the role that they may have played in the evangelization of the native population. I was interested in how these institutions fit or the extent that they fit into the Spanish imperial project. Questions about epidemic disease. I just had all these questions, and none of them had to do with madness. And then when I got to the archives, that was when I discovered that, you know, hospital records, they're the most boring, dry, mundane documents. so I went to the archives thinking I was going to find all this stuff
about patients, about doctors, about diseases. And hospital records just aren't like that. They're very bureaucratic. There was some expenses, a lot of kind of church documents, just things that were very hard to decipher. I didn't have the training at the time to kind of work with those kinds of documents. So I didn't know how I was going to kind of put this together into a dissertation. So my default was always going to be the Inquisition, because, you know, the Inquisition always has interesting stuff. So I remember kind of early on looking through the Inquisition records and kind of typing in hospital into the search engine. And that was when San Hipólito kept popping up. And I knew there was a mental hospital in Mexico City. I had read about that. I wasn't initially interested. I didn't want to write about madness, and I didn't want to work with the historiography. It's a very kind of Eurocentric, France and England centric kind of literature. I didn't want to go there. But the patients of San Hipólito, because they had mental illness, often appeared before the Inquisition and the secular criminal courts. And there was this interesting conversation happening at around the late 18th century where patients are increasingly getting diagnosed as mad, and they're getting funneled to San Hipólito. So that was how the project began. It began with my realization that this was one of the few colonial hospitals that I could work on, and I could write the institutional history that I had long been interested in researching about. But I also had unique access into the lives of some of its patients. And as I kind of point out in the book, it's really in the records of the Inquisition, where you hear the patients, where you hear their voices, where physicians come up, where you get all the kinds of details that you don't really get in those hospital records. So that was how the project came into being.
Okay, so let's talk about the book. I love this. So in the book, very early on, you tell us that San Hipólito was a very special institution. And it's kind of funny that you didn't find it interesting at the beginning, but because you make such a good case of how interesting it is as an institution. It is the first mental hospital of the New World. So its lifespan ranges from 1567 all the way up to 1910. So centuries, right? And even if it's so remarkable, its history has somewhat eluded traditional narratives of the history of psychiatry. So it's in a way, it's like an ideal thing to study, right? Something that has somewhat been a sort of hidden secret, or maybe an obvious secret. So tell us a little bit more about why these traditional histories of psychiatry have made San Hipólito's history unfathomable. You mentioned this in the introduction. And perhaps why you chose to name, to title your book Bedlam, because it is a name that is used for London's Bethlehem Hospital, as you tell us in the introduction too. So why is it important kind of to situate San Hipólito into like bigger histories or narratives about medicine, psychiatry, and science?
Yeah, no. So Bedlam, as you noted, is the name of London's Bethlehem Hospital, the most famous or infamous of the early mental hospitals in Europe. It's not the first mental hospital in Europe by any means, but it is the most well known. Shakespeare wrote about it. Hogarth, the 18th century engraver, immortalized Bedlam as it came to be known in art. So in the popular imagination, Bedlam, and this is where the word, Bedlam comes from, has become synonymous with kind of the world gone topsy-turvy. It's really a caricature of what people imagine these early mental institutions to be like, barbaric, places where men and women of all classes kind of intermingle, places that resort to chaining of patients to beds and into cages. It's really taken on a life of its own. And like early mental hospitals in general, there has been a lot written about Bedlam as a representation. But there's actually very little about the hospital itself and how it actually operated in daily life. And like San Hipólito's history, the history of Bedlam, like the history of a lot of these institutions, is quite mundane. It's not as sexy as the representations would have it. So given the hospital's notoriety, you know, the word bedlam appears in a lot of books on madness. There's Michael McDonald's Mystical Bedlam. Jonathan Sadowski has a book called Imperial Bedlam on colonial Nigeria. So it made a lot of sense that I would title my book Bedlam in the New World, because I was dealing with the first mental hospital of the Western Hemisphere, the Hospital de San Hipólito. And as I know, this is a history that has been really erased in histories of the histories of psychiatry, in part because the field has long been very Eurocentric. So the rise of psychiatry is very much a European story, centered in places like France, England, the United States. It's a story about the rise of these medical men, kind of the alienists, these early psychiatrists, and how they kind of infiltrated the hospital. And it's a story that has long been told. It has long been wedded to certain teleologies. It's a story of liberation, kind of doctors coming in and chaining the mad, rescuing them from this kind of era of barbarity, or it's told in kind of a regressive lens, a la Foucault, you know, the story where, you know, madmen are once free, they're allowed to wander, and then they're confined, and everything's downhill from there, right? Medicine exerts a kind of moral repression over the mentally ill. So it's really hard when you're writing about this, to get away from the geographical centering of Europe, but also away from these kinds of larger teleologies, these larger narratives about how the history of madness should be told. And I tried really hard in the course of putting this history together to try to say something different, and to try to narrate the history of madness in a different way. So in the story of San Hipólito, and I can say more about this, you know, it's really a story about the centrality of religious institutions, of religious personnel, of religious sensibilities to the management of madness in this kind of Spanish American setting, long before the rise of psychiatry.
Yes, so this is why this book is so important. I believe you're doing such important interventions by telling a really local, specific story. And so I think this book will be super important historiographically. I told you this before we started recording. I think you'll get, you know, awards for this book. So listeners, you have to read it. So let's talk more about it then. Let's talk about one of, you know, your arguments. So you tell us that San Hipólito served as both a microcosm and a colonial laboratory of the Hispanic Enlightenment. So let us start by talking about that concept of colonial laboratory. What do you mean by that? I know here, I mean, this, you're discussing a very specific set of literature, but for our listeners that perhaps, you know, are not familiar with this kind of terminology, what do you mean by that? Why is it important to understand San Hipólito as a colonial laboratory? What does that do to you and to us as listeners and readers?
Sure. And this is one of the developments too that I think happened when I was trying to kind of transition from a dissertation to a book, kind of think about the larger arguments and what else you can say. So I was constantly being asked when I was trying to revise this, I was constantly being asked to kind of to justify what I was doing vis-a-vis Mexico. So it wasn't enough for me to say that I was writing about the first mental hospital of the New World, or that I was including Mexico in a field that had long never talked about Latin America. I was constantly being told, so what, you have to say something else. And that's one of the challenges when you're trying to speak to, you know, the history of medicine in science, which is still very much a Europe-centered field, although that is changing. So the idea of a laboratory came into being when I was trying to think about, okay, well, what larger arguments can I make, and how can I place this hospital centered in Mexico City into conversation with larger developments taking place beyond its walls? So that was how the concept of the laboratory came in histories of 19th and 20th century colonialism. It's quite common to refer to the colonies as laboratories of modernity. Or places of where experiments are done, where social kind of engineering projects are implemented, where new knowledge is produced about nature, about race, about lots of things. You know, this is what the colonies often do for the rest of Europe. So, you know, building off of that, I suggested that San Hipólito was itself a laboratory that helped us to see the Enlightenment in different ways. So I decided in the course of, you know, revising the manuscript to really center the 18th century, because this was an 18th century story, and try to say something larger about what does the Enlightenment look like from the vantage point of this hospital in Mexico City. And what do we see? And we see there, we see how new ideas emanating from the Enlightenment, such as order, utility, rationalism, the public good, how they came to reshape new ideas about the medical and religious management of mental illness in this period. But the laboratory also sheds light on the centrality of religion, of religious personnel, in particular, the brothers of San Hipólito, who ran the administration from its inception, well into the 19th century, and were responsible for the administration of institutional healthcare for the mentally ill. So the laboratory sheds light on their role, and also unexpectedly, the Inquisition. The Inquisition as a tribunal that surprisingly, I argue, is one of the agents of medicalization in this period, and one of the tribunals that's really at the forefront in thinking about madness, thinking about madness in medical terms, and thinking about new uses of these institutions for the purposes of studying madness and diagnosing it in the most accurate way possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I feel really ambivalent towards that challenge you face, because it's a little bit frustrating that you were doing all of this important interventions, talking about this, the first mental hospital, bringing into the conversation, into a literature center in Europe, an institution that was neglected or silenced, and that you were pushed into, like, so what? It's a burden that a lot of us doing other regions have to face. But at the same time, I feel ambivalent, because that pushed you into making such important and bold and, you know, fascinating interventions. So I'm kind of ambivalent, you know, I can say a little bit frustrated, but also a little bit thankful, because it pushed you into kind of making broader arguments about the Hispanic Enlightenment in particular, but also about medicalization, also about, you know, colonial institutions. So we should talk more about those arguments that you've kind of already mentioned, and I think they deserve a little bit more kind of delving into them, right? So the Hispanic Enlightenment, you're dealing with a topic that for, you know, the last few decades has produced a lot of scholarship, a lot of new assessments about this topic have surfaced in the last few decades. I've had a lot of people here in the podcast talking about the Enlightenment. I had Bianca Premo, I had, you know, Martha Few, Adam Warren, Septor Torici, people you quote in your book, right? And you're part of this bigger conversation about the Hispanic Enlightenment, about talking about the Hispanic Enlightenment in different terms. So here you follow scholars such as Martha Few, who, for example, have asked that histories of medicine, and here I'm quoting you, take a more complex view of religion for this period, the 18th century, recognizing its critical and complex role in the formation of modern scientific modernity. So, you know, maybe some of our listeners, if they're new, they'll be surprised by this pairing of scientific modernity and religion. Maybe others, they'll be more familiar with this when we talk about co-production or interdependence between religion and scientific modernity. So tell us a little bit of about that literature, you're kind of that traditional literature you're kind of trying to challenge, because you're saying that some institutions that are usually considered like anti-modern, such as the Inquisition, are not, and that religion can foster Enlightenment ideas, and that the Enlightenment processes you're tracking here were produced within the confines of a religious and charitable institution. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate your ambivalence. Sometimes I was getting told that I was just adding Mexico, and it was hard not to get defensive, but it did force me to kind of hone in my arguments or really go out there and try to argue something. And I'm glad you mentioned Bianca Premo, whose book on the Enlightenment really inspired me, and the work of Martha Few, and Paul Ramirez as well, people that have started to kind of center the Enlightenment and think of Latin America as a place where we can talk about an Enlightenment that took place, and it not just be something kind of peripheral to what was happening in the rest of the world. So, I decided to focus on the Enlightenment, because as when I wrote the manuscript, it really turned into an 18th century story. And, and I was thinking a lot about, the Foucault and the history of madness and how I can resurrect that story and not kind of rehash the traditional, great confinement argument and whether or not these institutions are about social disciplining. I didn't want to rehash that argument, but I did feel that I had something interesting to say about the Enlightenment and what it looks like from the vantage point of an institution that is dedicated to the opposite of Enlightenment, to an unreason. And there was this old school medical historian that I recall reading, and he said, he was talking about Spain and how, Spain had been at the forefront, really. They had been very kind of precocious in dedicating a lot of resources to madness and to mental hospitals. And he says, Spain is the cradle of psychiatry, but she later neglected the infant. And what he means there is that, Spain was the cradle of psychiatry because it was one of the earliest places where mental hospitals appeared. But when he says she neglected the infant, what he goes on to say is that, centuries of religious fanaticism, of, the Inquisition, which is the pinnacle of the kind of Black legend, thinking about Spain, that all of that meant that all of these developments really amounted to nothing. So in many ways, the book kind of subverts that story, but also kind of reinforces it in that I tell a story about the centrality of religious sensibilities, everything from the charitable ethos that informed kind of the appearance of hospitals, San Hipólito in particular being dedicated to pobres dementes or mad paupers, to the role played by the Inquisition, that all of these religious sensibilities worked together in the 18th century to help transform the hospital and to turn the hospital into something more modern, and to kind of fuel the medicalization of madness. And I can say more about the Inquisition in a bit if you'd like.
Yes, you can tell us more, but before, let's tackle medicalization, because I believe it's one of those big topics in the book, in the literature, and it's one of, your arguments that are maybe, or that may be counterintuitive for some listeners, for some readers. And here you argue that, physicians are peripheral actors in the history of medicalization, which I'm laughing because it's kind of usually it's the other way around. It was not physicians or philosophers, but the clergy, and particularly the Brothers of San Hipólito, and more surprisingly still, the Inquisitors. So tell us more about these agents of medicalization and why is it important to bring these actors into this story, these neglected or people that we don't think are drivers of medicalization?
Yeah, no. So, you know, in my research, I realized early on that there wasn't a lot of physicians in the hospital records. I think I never came across like a physician salary. I came across very little doctors in the institution's records. And you know, I could talk about this in a bit. The doctors do appear, but they appear in the criminal and the inquisitorial courts. That's where they're exerting influence, but they're not in the hospital. And even then it took me a while to drive home that point. Cause I was just, it's almost like, you know, we just expect to see doctors there, and there's the assumption that they're there. So, you know, and it's commonplace now in the historiography of medicine in colonial Spanish America to note that there was a dearth of university trained practitioners in the Spanish American colonies. But what does this actually mean for medical practice? That's not something that I think we talk a lot about. I'm thinking here, there's the new great book by Pablo Gomez and Diego Armu on the gray zones of healing, which really does deal with these other practitioners, these unlicensed healers. But I think we're still trying to get a better picture of what medical practice looks like in the absence of a fully developed medical profession. So in this, in the case of San Hipólito, really at the forefront was this brotherhood, this religious order dedicated to hospitals, and they were known as the Ordenes Hospitalarios. There were four of them, but the one that ran this particular hospital was the Order of San Hipólito, and they ran the institution for about three centuries, and from what I can tell were not just well-versed in religious forms of healing and consoling patients, but also medically trained as well. So they're major players in this story. And the other major actors, unexpectedly, were the Inquisition. The inquisitors are at the forefront in thinking about the insanity defense. They're invested in the insanity defense, and they're invested in some of the most, they're at the forefront in furthering some of the most sophisticated and nuanced ways of thinking about the insanity defense. And they're also at the forefront in thinking about medical understandings of the insanity defense, because it was so important for the Inquisition to issue to hinge their verdict on a definitive diagnosis. They want proof, right? They want evidence. So they're marshaling in all these doctors, and in the process becoming unwitting, I would argue, agents of medicalization in this larger story of the Enlightenment. So on the one hand, the Inquisition is very much an unenlightened institution. You know, a lot of the philosophes excoriate against them. You know, their index of prohibited books is, you know, is all the bestsellers of the Enlightenment. And they're stamping down on a lot of kind of revolutionary thinking. But on the other hand, they're very progressive thinking, for lack of a better word, when it comes to thinking about mental illness, when it comes to thinking about who deserves the insanity defense and on what grounds. And they're very creative when it comes to thinking about the role that institutions and the Hospital de San Hipólito in particular play in the management of mental illness. So I think that was a big part of the story, is the role of the Inquisition, not just in this Enlightenment story, but really in these hospitals.
So I think it's kind of so funny. I think it's also like a modern expectation to find physicians in the past. I myself, you know, have suffered from this, like, and my dissertation is tentatively titled A World with No Doctors, because it was such an obvious truth back then, but perhaps for us today it's hard to imagine a world without doctors. But yeah, it's so interesting to think about these other actors that we usually don't pay much attention to, right? But I think I want us to talk about the Inquisition. You've been talking about it since the very beginning, and you tell us it is such an important institution, and the records for the Mexican Inquisitions are so rich. I feel so jealous when I read books about them, because there's so many details and so many cases, and they're so fascinating. And so I want to bring into your conversation an example you use. And you use this example to introduce chapter 3 of the book that is titled, "It is easy to mistake a heretic for a madman." And so in that chapter, you begin by discussing the case of a mulatto miner called Teodoro Francisco de Aspe y Guerra, who came before the headquarters of the Holy Office to declare himself the victim of hechicería, so of bewitchment. So he was having visions, hearing voices, having hallucinations, and he accused his estranged brother and sister-in-law, as well as some neighbors, of being responsible for his state of mind. So the Inquisition eventually dismissed Teodoro's denunciation, or they attributed his state of mind to what they called a melancholic imagination. So even though Teodoro was not sent to San Hipólito as a patient, you use this case to demonstrate that increasingly in the 18th century, cases such as this one were attributed to mental illnesses. So in this case, melancholia, instead of being attributed to cases of hechicería, right? And so this is part of the process mm-hmm. of medicalization you're trying to track. And one of the things I found really interesting in that case is that you said perhaps a century earlier, in the late 17th century, they would have taken this denunciation more seriously. Perhaps a century earlier, they would have investigated or even prosecuted some of the people he denounced. So, I mean, this is a counterfactual argument and we cannot be completely sure, but you find that there's increasing cases in which this argument about medical causes of a mental state are being put forward by inquisitors, also by doctors. So why is the Inquisition such kind of an important place for this discussion? Why was it in this institution rather than in other institutions where these discussions were being held? And what was it about the 18th century?
I love that case just because the denouncer Teodoro, he's so vivid in his description of what's happening to him. Again, you wouldn't find that level of detail in a hospital record. Physicians didn't keep that kind of documentation, but there it is in the Inquisition's records. Someone talking in rich detail about their symptoms and their hallucinations. It's great. And as you point out, by the 18th century, and in this particular case, they were very quick to dismiss the charges and say, you know, he's not mad, he's melancholic. So, you know, by the 18th century, the Inquisition is increasingly dismissing these charges or issuing the insanity defense, and they're issuing it on medical grounds, often with a medical diagnosis, although not always. And as I go on to point out, you know, the insanity defense has deep religious underpinnings. So within the context of the Inquisition, and this is probably what made it one of the ideal institutions for which to study this phenomena, you know, all sin needed to be, there needed to be intent in order for heresy to take place. So one needed to be cognizant if they committed a sin. So it had long been known that if somebody was mentally ill and they committed a crime, they weren't guilty because they had never really sinned in the first place. So this creates a situation where it's the Inquisition that is long invested in crimes of interiority, in interior states. They want to know conscience. They want to know what somebody was thinking at the time that they committed a particular crime. You know, the definition for heresy meant that, you know, there needed to be a lot of intent in order for heresy to occur. The crime needed to be with full intention and cognizance. And even then, you know, the suspect had to insist that was not able to recant in order to be tried as a heretic. So the bar for being a heretic was high. So the Inquisition has long been motivated to diagnose interiority. And I don't know why exactly by the 18th century, and a lot of it might have to do with the professionalization of physicians and physicians trying to kind of make a pitch for themselves, but doing so within the context of the inquisitorial courts. So by the 18th century, the Inquisition is increasingly wedded to more medical standards of proof. So it isn't enough for them to suspect that somebody is mentally ill. They want a concrete medical diagnosis. And particularly in certain cases, in really kind of complicated cases, they're looking for a firm medical diagnosis. So they're increasingly turning to physicians. And it's this pattern that you see over and over again. They're calling in doctors to help them diagnose interiority. They had long been in the business of assessing inward states, but now they increasingly want more empirical standards of proof. So that's kind of the story that I'm telling there. But as I point out, it's a story of medicalization, but it's also a very messy story in that inquisitors are invested in medical standards of proof, but at the same time, they are increasingly apprehensive that a suspect might be feigning. This was their greatest fear. It wasn't how you differentiate between kind of demonic possession and madness. It was how do you tell the difference between someone who is authentically ill and somebody who is just feigning for the purposes of dodging punishment. So the fear that somebody is feigning is constantly in their deliberations. So these trials often really spiral into these kind of long paper trails as they're kind of marshaling in all these doctors and trying to figure out what to do with particular suspects. And it often was the case, not always, but it was often the case that at some point they would get frustrated and they would default to the hospital as a strategy for managing mental illness. And I make the case there that in some cases, the hospital very much functioned as a real laboratory, a kind of a site of observation for which to scrutinize the authenticity and the progression of symptoms as the Inquisition is trying to kind of issue verdicts and is seeking more empirical forms of proof in the late 18th century in a way that it just hadn't done a century ago.
Yes, and so the Inquisition is an institution that was at the forefront for devising new models of undertaking the complexities of human reasoning and the nuances of intent, right? So, So for our listeners, it's kind of really interesting because like an institution, it's seen in a different light, an institution that, as we said earlier, has been portrayed as the antithesis to modernity, right? To science or to all of these things. So I found that argument super interesting.
I think I was very much inspired there with, I think it's Irene Silverblatt right. kind of look who kind of says, you know, that this is a bureaucratic institution, right? In many ways, it's pre-modern in many ways, but it's actually quite modern in other ways.
Yeah. And you said like, this is a very bureaucratic institution. And one of the things I think listeners will find useful to know is that the Inquisition always relied on witnesses. But before the 18th century, it was more common that, you know, to rely on neighbors, families, priests, sort of communal witnesses, let's call them like that. But increasingly, you find physicians were called in the 18th century, and there was this interest in kind of medicalizing or giving mental states a natural explanation, right? And this is central to your argument, but it's also important to your argument, not only the Inquisition, but also the criminal secular courts. So in the 18th century, the Bourbon dynasty passed a series of reforms that were meant to, among many other things, increase revenue, expand the colonial judiciary, fortify the police force, and combat growing levels of crime. Yet this interest in law and order, unlike what some of followers of Foucault may think, and you've already said this, this interest falls short in explaining why the criminally insane were sent to San Hipólito, right? So it wasn't just to confine them and control them. So there was a paternalistic leniency in this policy. Can you tell us more about the criminal courts? You mentioned in the chapter dedicated to criminal courts that these cases were different, right? Because the criminal courts are designed for a different purpose. So usually it was people perhaps saying that they were mad when the crime occurred, or perhaps, you know, similar to the Inquisition, it could happen that they eventually, for some reason, became mad in the process, but it's a different type of judicial process or court. What is it about, you know, criminal courts that you want us, our listeners, to know?
All right. So you know, quite surprisingly, the secular criminal courts, it's kind of counterintuitive. They were a lot more backward thinking, I think, when it came to deploying the insanity defense. They were latecomers in embracing the medicalization of insanity, and they were far more pragmatic in their use of a hospital like San Hipólito for the purposes of managing the problem of criminal insanity. And in many ways, the story that I tell here is the story of a kind of a failed enlightenment. So as you point out, this is the period when the Bourbon reforms are at their pinnacle, when there's lots of new policies being implemented to combat what is perceived to be escalating levels of urban crime. So there's efforts to expand the judiciary. There's the rise of new law enforcement agencies, efforts to kind of remap the city in an attempt to better combat crime. And at the same time, Enlightenment reformers are calling for the reform of criminal law, saying that punishment in criminal cases should be just and it should be more proportionate to the crime. So this is kind of the era where scholars locate the birth of the prison. But when you look at the actual cases themselves, I think I referred to them at one point as circuses, because, you know, while all these reforms are happening, in cases involving insanity, it's quite messy. So for the secular criminal court, you know, the Inquisition, by contrast, is a tribunal of faith. They're interested in states of interiority. They're interested in the kind of the innermost recesses of thought, in cognitive states. You don't really see that level of sophistication in the secular criminal context. They're willing to issue an insanity defense, but they're not interested in questions of intent on the same level. That's not happening there. What they're interested in is the problem of how do we manage individuals who are potentially violent and potentially prone to cause problems on the street, potentially prone to disturb the public peace. So for them, the how, the why, I mean, mattered far less to them than the how. How do we manage criminals who are technically innocent but potentially prone to violence? So the hospital comes into play there as a way to contain and to confine criminals that are potentially violent. And as I point out, this isn't a story of criminalization of the mentally ill or of social repression. It's a story really of kind of the ad hoc implementation of the insanity defense, of the role of local authorities, of neighbors, of family in deciding what do we do with the violently ill. And as I also point out, to get to this point about paternalistic leniency, even while there's these calls for the reform of criminal law, the kind of law that the justices are falling back on are really these kind of old medieval laws, which have long protected the mentally ill from unwarranted punishment.
So it's a it's really their story of a kind of failed enlightenment project to make the law more kind of more just in this more modern sense.
Yes, very interesting. It's like what we've been talking about, a combination of tradition versus a combination of modern ideas. Even if that product is a failed one, we see that. And that is what defines the Hispanic Enlightenment. I believe you mentioned that at some point in the book. Okay, so I believe we've covered the main arguments, some of the content of your chapters. Listeners know that we cannot talk about everything. I like to usually tell listeners about how the books are organized. So this book is divided in 5 chapters. The first 2 chapters are, in a way, the more detailed story of San Hipólito as an institution. So the first chapter talks about the foundation of the hospital by Bernardino Álvarez and places this story in a context of Iberian imperial expansion, both in Europe and the Americas. The second chapter deals more particularly with the history of San Hipólito in the 18th century. Also a little bit about what happened in the 17th century, a decline that the hospital experienced. And then in the 18th century, there were some transformations and renovations. And this happened in the context of the Bourbon reform. So these are the first 2 chapters. Is there something that, this is a long history. Listeners will, I'm sure they would love to go and read the books and find out more details, but is there something about this super long history that perhaps we missed and you want our listeners to know?
I think you outlined the general kind of trajectory of this hospital from kind of this more kind of medieval institution, dedicated to hospitality, dedicated to pobres dementes, and it's kind of uneven medicalization in the 18th century under kind of the Bourbon reforms and the role of religious reformers in kind of reshaping that space. I think what I would like to flag for listeners is the discussion of the hospital's patient population that occurs in Chapter 2 based on San Hipólito's most comprehensive surviving register of patient admissions. So I was fortunate enough to find this this register of, I think, roughly kind of a little over 30 years of patient admissions. And it's a really nice counterpoint to the cases, because the cases, the Inquisition and the criminal cases, are really the heart of the book. But in many ways, those cases are exceptional, right? There are people that got into trouble and made their way to these records. But over here, you get a fuller picture of what the patient population looked like, and lots of stories of patients whose stories are forgotten. They're just these kind of faint glimpses of that were jotted down by the enfermero mayor, the head nurse, who kept track of which patients came in, when they got discharged, who died in the hospital, who escaped, who committed suicide. So I think that's what I would like to flag for readers.
And it was mostly men, right? So at some point, women were taken into his hospital, but you say, like, at some point, it seemed that it was mostly men, that there was another hospital, if I'm not mistaken, it was Divino Salvador, that was just for women. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we know that most of the patients we're talking about are men, right?
It's exclusively men. Yeah. So I believe they may have admitted women. It's never quite clear. They had ambitions to admit women. But by the 17th century, it's exclusively a male hospital. And by that point, there is a hospital, El Divino Salvador, para pobres mujeres dementes, that is established exclusively for the problem of mad women. And that hospital, unfortunately, its records simply eluded me. I could not locate them. So I would have loved to have written about both of the institutions, but I can only gesture to El Divino Salvador whenever possible.
Oh, that's so unfair to women. but I mean, hopefully, I don't know if it's possible, you know, in archives, things may turn up later. That can happen, or they may be lost forever, and it's a loss for humanity. But it's a great thing that you were able to find these detailed records of one single institution for 300 years. It's amazing. So perhaps, you know, listeners, you also want to know that the three remaining chapters so are about what we've been discussing. So chapter 3 and 4 are about the Inquisition, and chapter 5 is about the criminal courts. So I want listeners to know that these three chapters are filled with stories about people. We've just talked about one of them, Teodoro, but there are many more cases, many more examples that talk about, you know, human beings. So maybe, I don't know, Cristina, if you want, I mean, you can talk about whatever you want, but any of these stories kind of stood out for you, or is there something about the human side of the story that you want our listeners to hear more about?
I'll mention my favorite patient, but yeah, no, the human side, you know, really comes through the cases. Sometimes when you're working with these and you're being very academic about it, you forget the real, the real suffering that's at the heart of a lot of these cases. That's a great point. But I think my favorite patient to talk about is Jose Ventura Gonzalez, who was nicknamed Tebanillo. And his case isn't that compelling or that interesting. I think what's most interesting is that he's the patient that left behind a huge bundle of sketches that the Inquisition kept. So I have these great drawings by this mental patient. He was institutionalized twice at San Hipólito. I think the first time he was institutionalized, he got out. And then he got into trouble with the Inquisition and they institutionalized him again. And the second round, they preserved his writings, which is a combination of poetry, of prose, very hard to make out, and these great drawings. And he was an embroiderer by occupation. So some of the drawings are actually his embroidery, and you can see little pin marks where he was stitching, and then other drawings of pornographic content, which clearly incensed the Inquisition and may have informed their verdict to ultimately send them back to San Hipólito. And I make the point that that the drawings themselves kind of materialize the larger problem of diagnosing locura in the Inquisition courts, because you have this, here you have clear evidence that heretical statements were made, that there is a heretical blasphemous thinking at work here, but yet how do you know what the intent was, what the person's cognitive state was? This is what I call in the book the inquisitor's quandary, this kind of moral predicament that inquisitors find themselves in as they're trying to decide whether to issue somebody the insanity defense or to punish them for the crime.
Yes, and those drawings, there are many of these drawings they're in the book, listeners. So it's amazing. It's amazing the richness of the inquisitorial records. I think it's this type of records can give historians so much to work on and with. So, okay, we arrive to the conclusion of your book. This takes us to the 19th century, the closing decades of the Spanish rule, the early years of the Republic. So in this period, members of the Order of San Hipólito remain in the hospital, I think for a few decades, 2 decades perhaps, if I remember correctly. But they suffer the steady infiltration of a handful of ambitious medical men, right? And they were armed, many of them, with the latest psychiatric theories of Europe. So ironically, you say this, the people, the drivers of locuras, of madness, medicalization, lost control of a process they helped unleash. So what can you tell us about, very briefly, right, so our listeners kind of think about your conclusion, what can you tell us about this moment where physicians gain control of what we now call psychiatry?
Yeah, so the book kind of ends where I think traditional accounts of psychiatry begin, with the rise of kind of early psychiatrists, or the alienists, and their efforts to kind of infiltrate and gain a monopoly on the hospital. So the rise of psychiatry is predicated on the ability of medical men to monopolize an institution that had once been governed by religious personnel, religious figures. So to get a monopoly over that space, so that they can transform it into a site of clinical observation. And so they have ready access, right, to a wide body of patients for which to develop theories of how the mind works or does not. So that's the kind of the story I gesture to at the very end. But as I point out there, this new kind of stage in San Hipólito's history, where you know psychiatry is launched within the wards of San Hipólito, this new phase isn't the beginning of medicalization, as I point out in the conclusion. It's simply this new phase. Right, with kind of a phase that we're much more familiar with. So it's kind of the end of this other world. And as you just noted, Lisette, the brothers of San Hipólito, the order is dissolved with independence, but they remain in the hospital for another two decades. So it's watching this all unfold. So yes, they lose control of this institution that they had once so imperfectly managed.
Okay, so I'm going to make the obvious question that many people make about this type of stories, but I like to make them because I believe it's important to think about the present. It's kind of, why is this history important, right? So San Hipólito closed its doors in 1910. And perhaps some are, I hope many of our listeners, perhaps they are not super familiar with Mexican history or Latin American history more generally. So why do you think it's important that we revisit these stories about the past today?
Gosh, that's a great question. I don't even know if I answered that successfully in my epilogue. I was so tired, and I was trying to gesture to the present. But you know, 1910 isn't just the official close of San Hipólito. It's the opening of La Castañeda, Mexico's first modern psychiatric establishment. So it's this interesting comparison where you see the rise of the opening of the first modern psychiatric asylum, with all the glories that accompany its opening, but also all the baggage that psychiatry carries as well, and the kind of close of this older colonial religious model for managing mental health. So it's this interesting juxtaposition, and you know, I try to tell a kind of a story of. There's obvious change there in the kind of the closing of one and the aperture of another. But there's a lot of continuities in both of those histories. You know, both institutions face similar problems. They face problems of, you know, in the case of Mexico, of, you know, religious models of charitable care still asserting themselves well into the 19th and 20th century. And they face a similar problem of how do you manage a condition which often there isn't a cure. You know, this is something that plagued San Hipólito, plagued 18th century religious personnel who were managing madness, but it plagued psychiatrists as well. This is one of the things that's kind of hindered, you know, psychiatry's ascendancy, is that they're often limited when it comes to making claims about curability. So, I mean, it's a story of lots of continuity, and you see sort of when medicine kind of reaches its limits. And I guess I will say why this story is important for the present. You know, we talk a lot about mental health care now, and you know, this is in the aftermath of deinstitutionalization. So, you know, widespread movements to shutter asylums because of the atrocities that were committed inside of them. But We're kind of back at square one in a sense. You know, what do you do with people that were San Hipólito's original patients? Poor people, people of limited means, people who didn't have family, and people who needed a shelter, a custodial solution to the management of mental health. I mean, this is a problem that modern societies deal with on a present basis. So that's, I think that's why the story is, I think, still relevant today.
And I agree. Challenges that we're facing today, you know, COVID, I mean, has brought up the topic of mental health. Mm-hmm. Pressingly, we cannot avoid it. So I think your book is a tremendous contribution. It's a great read, listeners. Believe me, it reads wonderfully. The cases are super interesting. So I cannot recommend it enough. So before I let you go, Cristina, maybe you can tell us what you're working on. What are your current or future projects so our listeners kind of look forward to the future?
So I'm trying to launch a second book now, and I'm still interested in, I'm trying to go back and address the questions that I don't think I got to address with this book. So I'm still interested in kind of these other questions I had about colonial hospitals. And I think the question I'm asking myself is, you know, what is colonial about a colonial hospital? So that's what I'm working on right now. I'm interested in Hernán Cortés's hospital and the history of kind of military and colonial expansion and the rise of these institutions and the rise of public health. I'm hoping to do more work on indigenous hospitals and their kind of role in religious conversion. And the other piece that I'm working on, and I'm a little more further along in on that regard, is the nursing orders. So not just the Order of San Hipólito, which ran about 12 hospitals in colonial Mexico, very active hospital order. But the Order of San Juan de Dios was another hospital order. So I'm interested, trying to write something right now on the history of nursing and kind of religious nursing as part of this other project on public health in colonial Latin America.
Love it. Can't wait to hear more about it, especially about San Juan de Dios. I am, you know, in New Granada, there was...
They're all over the place.
They are all over the place.
They were global order. So they were quite impressive.
They were. They keep popping up in my documents. So please publish so I can read and learn more. But, you know, for now, thank you so much. I'm super grateful for your time and for this book. And this was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the thought you put into this.
Okay. Bye-bye, listeners.